Welcome to the Deep Dive. Have you ever noticed how clean traditional fantasy usually is?
Oh, definitely. It's usually very black and white.
Right. You know the drill. It's like a textbook medical diagnosis. You break your arm, the doctor holds up the x-ray, points to that jagged white line, and says, there's the problem.
Yeah, and then they just fix it.
Exactly. In a classic fantasy story, a farm boy pulls a sword from a stone, or, I don't know, a bearded wizard shows up at the door with a mysterious letter, and boom, the hero crosses a magical threshold. Their old, boring life is just gone forever.
Right. It's binary. You are either normal or you are magical. There's no in-between.
Yeah. And, I mean, we gravitate toward those narratives, right?
I do, yeah. Because they offer a sense of order. There's this deep comfort and visibility in knowing exactly when the adventure starts and what the rules of the new world are.
But then you step into the real world.
Where things are entirely different.
Right. You step into the landscape of neurodevelopment or deeply ingrained psychology or, you know, trauma.
Yeah.
And suddenly that x-ray machine is broken.
You aren't dealing with clean breaks anymore.
No, not at all. The line between normal and transformed is incredibly murky, which actually brings us to our mission for today's deep dive.
I'm really excited for this one.
Same here. We are exploring what happens when a creator takes that murky, complex psychological reality and uses it to completely rewire a classic fantasy trope.
And we have some really incredible source material to look at today.
We do. We've got a fascinating stack of materials in front of us from an independent author named R.F. Ryan. We're looking at his website notes, his author bio, and an extensive excerpt from a completed manuscript.
Which is massive, by the way.
Oh, yeah. It's a 101,475-word epic currently seeking a literary agent, and it's titled Legacy of the Lost, The Talisman.
It's a really weighty piece of work.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because it's not just your standard fantasy fare, is it?
No, not at all. To really grasp what Ryan is doing with this manuscript, we have to look at the lens he's looking through. He isn't just a fantasy enthusiast. His real-world professional background is in counseling psychology, and he's taking this concept he first started imagining when he was just 10 years old.
Wait, 10 years old?
Yeah, a story about a boy destined to become a dragon. But he's elevating it into something much heavier now. This isn't just a sword and sorcery tale. It is a deliberate, highly structured allegory about human resilience, trauma, and really the complex nature of identity.
Wow. And looking at his bio, you can see the epic scale right away. He cites being raved on the titans of the genre. We're talking J.R.R. Tolkien, J.K. Rowling, George R.R. Martin.
The heavy hitters.
Exactly. So the vast world building, the clash between luminous and shadowed worlds, that architectural foundation is all there. But Ryan had this specific quote on his website that really caught my eye.
Oh, the one about sacrifice.
Yeah. He writes, "Anything worth having demands sacrifice." And keeping his counseling background in mind, I look at this setup and it feels like a Trojan horse for therapy.
That is a great way to put it.
Right. He's smuggling these profound psychological truths about grief right inside a story about a teenager turning into a giant serpent. But I mean, I have to push back a little here because I'm genuinely stuck on this.
Sure.
If I'm picking up a fantasy book, I want magic and dragons.
Yeah.
Does applying this heavy clinical psychological framing risk making the fantasy elements feel, I don't know, like homework? Doesn't it drag down the wonder of the magic?
Well, what's fascinating here is that grounding the magic in psychology doesn't drag it down at all. It actually raises the stakes exponentially.
Really? How so?
If we look at traditional fantasy, magic is almost always framed as a gift or a tool. It's a wand handed to you in a shop.
Right, like a cool accessory.
Exactly. But Ryan's text specifically notes that the protagonist's magic is an inheritance that awakens.
Oh, awakens. That's a very specific word choice.
It is. It is not merely given. It's dormant, tied to a lineage written into his very blood. By mechanizing the magic this way, the fantasy becomes a literal exploration of generational trauma.
Wow. Generational trauma.
Yeah. In clinical psychology, generational trauma refers to how the effects of intense suffering are passed down through families. It alters how descendants process stress and identity.
So it's not just a cool power.
No, in this story, the magic itself is a burden of the past demanding to be felt. It's an inheritance you can't just put back on the shelf.
So the consequence is what actually shapes the character. The magic isn't a superpower. It's an unresolved family history.
That is the core mechanism of the story. And understanding that psychological framework is crucial, because it completely changes how the inciting incident plays out.
Right, because usually you'd get the wizard at the door.
Exactly. But when the story actually kicks off, we don't get a whimsical mentor arriving with a map. We get a massive, jarring emotional rupture.
Let's dive into that, because the sensory details of how this begins are just incredible. We are dropped into the summer of 1984.
Great setting.
Yeah. And our protagonist, Caleb, is a 17-year-old orphan. 2 years prior, he lost his parents in a tragic accident, and he's still navigating that profound grief.
Which is a heavy weight for a teenager.
Absolutely. He's living on a 92-acre Pennsylvania farm with his grandparents, Aggie and Magnus. And the text describes his day-to-day life as incredibly slow and repetitive. It feels like this meticulously constructed buffer against the chaos he's trying to outrun.
It's a manufactured safety.
Yeah.
Yeah, in trauma psychology, we often see patients build highly rigid routines to create a false sense of control when their internal world feels unpredictable.
But then that rigid buffer just shatters.
It completely shatters.
Caleb comes back from the creek one day, and the farmhouse door is wide open, which, Caleb notes, Magnus never, ever does.
Never.
The kitchen smells strongly of burnt toast.
Mm.
There's a steaming cup of coffee and a chipped mug on the table, and Magnus's carved cane, the one he's supposedly never leaves behind, is just leaning against the counter.
Right.
Magnus has completely vanished.
And the local sheriff eventually comes out, you know, pokes around the tree line with a flashlight and just chalks the whole thing up to early onset dementia.
Right. He assumes Magnus just wandered off.
Yeah. But Caleb knows his grandfather. Magnus didn't forget things. And the atmosphere in the farmhouse that night is incredibly tense.
Yeah, and then Aggie does something really unexpected.
She hands Caleb an envelope she found hidden in Magnus's study. And inside is this strange round talisman on braided leather.
And it pulses, right?
Yes. The text says it pulses faintly, almost like it has a biological heartbeat of its own. And it's covered in ancient symbols that match the carvings on his grandfather's abandoned cane.
So creepy. And there's a note, too.
Wrapped around it is a cryptic note from Magnus that just says, "When the time is right, you'll know what to do."
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Later that night, the literal environment starts to break down.
It does.
The sky dims. Shadows start curling up the bedroom walls like fingers. The horizon outside bleeds this violent red. Caleb looks out the window and sees a tall, unmoving, shadowy figure at the edge of the tree line, described as something made of smoke and memory.
It's a terrifying image.
It really is.
Yeah.
So Caleb instinctively puts the talisman around his neck, and it burns hot against his chest. And then we get the physical transformation.
This part is so visceral.
His skin thickens into scales. His muscles violently surge. His hands twist into claws. He looks in the mirror and sees a gold-eyed serpent staring back.
A literal dragon.
A literal dragon. And he lets out this roar that shatters the bedroom windows and, as the text explicitly states, cracks time.
Yes.
Now, I'm reading this and I'm a bit confused, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds like a standard Godzilla action moment.
Sure, it reads like an action set piece.
Right. So how is a teenager turning into a roaring monster a deep psychological allegory? Isn't it just, you know, a cool action sequence?
Well, if you look closely at the phrasing Ryan uses, the mechanism of the scene reveals the psychology. The text specifies that the roar that shatters the windows does not come from the shadowy creature outside in the trees.
Okay.
The roar comes from within Caleb. What we are witnessing isn't just a magical transformation. It is the physical manifestation of a teenager's repressed grief finally boiling over.
Wow.
For 2 years, Caleb has pushed down the trauma of losing his parents, hiding behind the quiet routine of the farm. But the disappearance of his grandfather strips away his last remaining safety net.
So the emotional dam just breaks.
Exactly.
So the magic is the catalyst for the emotion he hasn't been allowed to feel.
Yes. And if we connect this to the bigger picture laid out in the author's notes, the talisman acts as a beacon. Ancient factions and prophecies have been waiting for this exact moment.
Right.
By finally feeling the full, overwhelming weight of his lineage and the full weight of his accumulated grief, Caleb's internal eruption alters the physical world.
He literally shatters the glass of his safe, manufactured reality.
He does.
But usually, you know, in this genre, after the farm boy turns into a magical creature and shatters reality, there is no going back. He grabs his sword, leaves the farm, and goes off to fight the Dark Lord.
The standard hero's journey.
Right. But Ryan does something completely unexpected here. Instead of a grand adventure, the brain tries to forcefully reset to normal.
Because that is how the human mind actually responds to severe trauma. You don't just instantly accept a new, terrifying reality. The mind tries to protect itself through denial.
Which brings us to the psychological whiplash of what happens next. Caleb wakes up in his own bed, gasping for air.
Like it was all a dream.
Exactly. The lace curtains are blowing in a gentle breeze, and the windows that he just shattered are completely intact. He tries to convince himself it was just a wildly vivid nightmare.
But the physical symptoms are still there.
Right. His skin still itches like he was wearing something much heavier a moment ago. His chest is incredibly tight. He reaches for his collarbone and realizes the physical talisman is missing.
It's gone.
And then he looks out the window and the environment is just wrong.
The glitch in reality.
Yes. Yesterday was thick, humid, peak summer. Now the trees are entirely bare. The weather is crisp, brittle autumn. The seasons have inexplicably skipped forward.
It's so disorienting.
Very. And then he runs downstairs. And Magnus, the grandfather who vanished into thin air the day before, is just sitting at the kitchen table drinking coffee and reading the morning paper.
Acting like nothing happened.
Completely normal. Though Caleb does notice a faint smear of dirt on Magnus's collar, which implies he really was somewhere else entirely. And Aggie is standing at the counter, casually packing Caleb's school lunch in a brown paper bag.
It's a total mind bender.
It feels like the Twilight Zone. It's like that deeply dissociative feeling where the world looks exactly the same, but all the furniture of reality has been moved slightly to the left.
You were describing the clinical reality of dissociation perfectly.
Yeah. He even walks to Greystone High School, passing gravel lots and teenagers with boomboxes playing the country song Why Not Me.
Yeah.
And everything around him feels hyper-real. But I keep coming back to this choice by the author. Why deliberately take this cosmic, time-bending, bloodline-awakening magical event and place it right next to something as agonizingly mundane as Mrs. Talbot's English class on the Odyssey or, you know, Caleb having a crush on a girl named Katie Harper? It feels so jarring to read.
This raises an important question because that jarring feeling you experienced as a reader is exactly what Ryan is engineering.
Oh, really?
Yes. He is putting the reader through cognitive dissonance. In psychology, cognitive dissonance occurs when a person's brain is forced to hold two deeply conflicting beliefs or realities at the exact same time.
Okay, that makes sense.
The brain cannot handle the friction of those two opposing truths, which creates intense, almost unbearable anxiety.
Because Caleb's brain is simultaneously holding, I am an ancient magical creature whose grandfather disappeared, and I need to finish my math homework.
Precisely. The environment is effectively gaslighting him. His sensory processing is dialed up to 11. He's hyper-aware of the distant hum of a leaf blower, the metallic tang of magic still in his mouth, the exact crunch of gravel under his shoes.
Right, but nobody else notices.
Everyone around him is completely oblivious, worrying about crumpled paper balls and the upcoming school harvest ball. The juxtaposition of ancient mythology against scuffed high school lockers violently isolates the protagonist.
He's totally alone.
He is trapped alone between a mythical destiny and suffocating normalcy.
And that friction creates a pressure cooker. I mean, you can't just sit in English class smelling jock dust while your mind is stuck on a monstrous transformation.
No, you have to do something.
Right. He has to confront the source of this gaslighting. Which brings us to the aftermath of that school day, where Caleb returns to what is supposed to be his ultimate safe haven.
The farmhouse. And Ryan paints a very specific picture here.
He does.
The house is cozy, scented with cedar. Aggie is in the kitchen humming a tune while making chicken soup. Tucker, the aging golden retriever, is lazily following Caleb around the halls. It is the absolute idyllic picture of domestic routine.
But Caleb refuses to play along anymore.
He's done with it.
Yeah, he marches straight up to Magnus, who is casually flipping through the newspaper in his armchair, and demands answers. Caleb lays it all out. The disappearance, the burnt toast, the envelope, the talisman, the violent dream, the fact that it's suddenly autumn.
And Magnus's reaction is very telling.
He completely dismisses him. He doesn't just deny it. He minimizes Caleb's experience. He blames Caleb's overactive imagination, suggests he's eating too close to bedtime, physically pats him on the shoulder in a patronizing way, and walks away into the living room.
Classic deflection.
And Caleb then frantically tears apart Magnus's study, which is loaded with dense books on history and mythology, but finds absolutely nothing. No secret compartments, no missing cane, no talisman.
Nothing to validate his experience.
So what does this all mean? I really need your take on Magnus here. Is he an antagonist who is actively gaslighting his grandson to keep him weak? Or is he a protector trying to keep Caleb safe through denial?
That ambiguity is where the counseling background truly shines. In family systems therapy, we see this dynamic constantly.
Really?
Yes. Often, the older generation attempts to shield the younger generation from the family's inherited traumas or dark histories by simply refusing to acknowledge them.
Oh, wow. So Magnus thinks he's helping.
Magnus likely believes that by denying the magic, by denying the traumatic lineage, he can force Caleb to have a normal, safe, mundane life.
But that doesn't work, does it?
No! From a clinical perspective, forced denial doesn't erase trauma. It just makes the victim doubt their own sanity. By withholding the truth, Magnus forces Caleb to fight a war on two fronts.
The magic awakening inside him and the family trying to convince him he's losing his mind.
Exactly.
But the final scene of this excerpt answers the question of whether Caleb is actually losing his mind, and it does so in such a grounded way. The landline rings. Caleb answers it, and it's his boisterous best friend, Jimmy.
Right, the real world calling.
Yeah. Jimmy is going a mile a minute about a kegger happening in the woods behind the old quarry. He's hyping Caleb up, specifically mentioning that Caleb's crush, Katie, is going to be there. It is the most grounding, trivial, universally recognizable teenage conversation possible.
It's the anchor of the mundane world pulling at him.
Right. And I want you, listening to this, to think about this dynamic in your own life for a second. Think about the invisible weights or internal struggles you carry under your skin as you navigate your normal day.
That's a great point.
You might be sitting in a sterile conference room for a meeting, or on a phone call with a friend talking about something totally trivial like a dinner reservation or a spreadsheet. But underneath that polite exterior, you are carrying the massive, unseen weight of a personal crisis.
Yeah, a health scare, a breakup, a buried grief.
Exactly. Things that nobody else in the room can see, but that are completely consuming your reality.
We all carry those hidden landscapes. And Ryan visualizes that internal reality brilliantly. Right in the middle of this totally normal conversation with Jimmy about a high school party, Caleb looks up and sees an inky black shadow manifesting in the periphery of his grandmother's bright, cozy kitchen.
Just creaking in.
The ancient traumatic world is literally bleeding through the wallpaper of the mundane world. But the most crucial detail of the entire excerpt happens right after Caleb hangs up the phone.
The ember.
Yes. Caleb presses his fingers to his collarbone, right to the exact spot where the heavy leather and metal of the talisman had rested during the transformation.
But the physical object is entirely gone. He is just touching bare skin.
But the heat of the talisman remains. It's described beautifully in the text as an ember under ash.
It's a permanent brand.
It is the ultimate psychological truth of the narrative. The magic, the trauma, the inheritance, the grief is no longer an external accessory.
Right. It's not a necklace he can take off or lose or hand back to his grandfather.
No. It has been absorbed. It has become internalized. His biology and his fundamental identity have been irreversibly changed by the awakening.
Wow.
In psychological terms, healing from trauma doesn't mean the event unhappens. It means integrating that traumatic experience into who you are now. Caleb is beginning that terrifying process of integration.
It really is a masterclass in using genre fiction to explore the human condition.
It truly is.
So, to wrap up our journey today, we set out to see how a background in counseling psychology could rewire a classic fantasy trope, and R.F. Ryan has delivered something incredibly layered.
Beyond expectations, honestly.
Yeah. Legacy of the Lost is clearly not just a story about a farm boy finding a magic necklace and fighting a monster. It is a narrative where magical awakenings serve to physically mirror the very real, very messy process of confronting buried grief. It shows us what it looks like to navigate the intense cognitive dissonance of trauma, and ultimately how we must internalize our own painful histories to discover our actual power.
It takes the traditional outward-facing hero's journey and turns the lens violently inward. The monsters you have to defeat aren't just hiding in the dark woods.
Right.
They're woven directly into your own family tree.
And for you listening, this deep dive is really a shortcut to understanding the broader evolution of modern fantasy. We are moving so far beyond simple escapism.
It's a whole new frontier.
It is. Today's fantasy isn't just a place to hide from the real world. It is becoming a profound mirror for our own emotional resilience. We're not just crossing clean binary thresholds anymore. We are exploring the murky, complicated fractures within ourselves.
Yeah.
We are looking at that metaphorical x-ray we talked about at the beginning and realizing that the break isn't in the bone. The break is in the world around us, and we have to figure out how to live in it.
Which leaves us with a fascinating and perhaps challenging question to consider as we close this out.
I'd love to hear it.
If our inherited traumas and family histories inevitably shape the core of our identity, what happens when we finally stop trying to outrun them and instead allow them to awaken and transform us?